Okay, so this is an interview with artist Caroline Rothwell. My name is Deborah Beck, and the interview is taking place in her studio in O'Connor Street, Chippendale. It's the 20th of June 2013. The interview is part of the Art and Artists in Sydney Oral History Project, which is being conducted on behalf of the City of Sydney's History Program. So I'll mainly talk about the public art projects and commission that you recently did in the city, but I'll ask some background questions at first. So you were born in England and studied first at the Wimbledon School of Art in London. Were you interested in sculpture at the beginning of your studies?
When I went to art school, I hadn't done any art at school because my family, it was not on anyone's radar. It was sort of, you know, smart people didn't do art. So when I first went to art school, I knew I had this kind of urge to make stuff, and maybe going back even a year, I'd actually spent a year in Australia just travelling around, just sort of seeing the world.
So between school and art school?
Yes, between school and art school, I spent a year here. And I just discovered landscape, I discovered space, I discovered drawing, and it was such a incredible experience that I decided I needed to go to art school. But I probably didn't have the confidence to think, oh, I'm going to be a painter or a sculptor. So I decided I was going to do theatre design because that seemed a kind of practical thing to do. But within a year of art school, I knew I wasn't going to do theatre design because I was just obsessively kind of drawing and painting. And then I went to Camberwell College into the painting department. And after about 6 months, where I was kind of putting plaster and clay and things all over canvases, one of my lecturers said to me, have you ever considered that you might be in the wrong department, that you should be in the sculpture department? And I basically moved the same day into sculpture, and it was just such an obvious place for me to be.
So that was in, what years were you
that
there?
That was 90 to 93, I think, yeah.
So you did one year of painting and then into sculpture? How long did you go?
It was a foundation. I did foundation at Wimbledon, which is the everything, and then I did a few months at Camberwell in painting and then moved into the sculpture. Yeah. But it was pretty broad. It was just, I suppose, when they were starting to dismantle the different faculties and move everyone together anyway, so we kind of were pretty fluid, but... But it was just great being with the, I suppose, just the materials and the equipment, you know, different setup.
Did you stay in London when you finished your studies?
I had one kind of pop-up exhibition in London, and then I went to Greece with a friend, and I met my future partner on a nudist beach on a Greek island.
That would do it.
Actually, neither of us were nude.
Oh,
we
okay.
were both reading interesting books, but anyway, I think I spent a year after I finished my degree maybe less. No, that's right, because it was actually, I was still at art school when I met him. So then I inadvertently moved to New Zealand. Probably because he had a job opportunity. I had no work, so he said, let's go to New Zealand for a bit.
So what nationality?
He's a New Zealander.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And that's even though I'd spent a year in Australia, that was how I ended up coming back to this side of the planet. Mm. And ended up there for quite a long time.
All right, so that... I noticed that you did some work in New York in between.
Yeah,
was that in between?
So while I was in New Zealand, it was really amazing. But I suppose I missed the hub, the energy. It was a really important research time for me because I basically didn't know anyone, and I just sort of locked myself away in a studio, researched, kind of worked in a way that I wouldn't have done if I'd stayed in London, because I would have had to have, you know, spent every hour God gave just, you know, making a living and doing work, you know, stealing hours when I could, which is what most of my friends did. Whereas in New Zealand, I could get a, you know, badly paid job, but really life was so much cheaper that I could spend a lot of time developing the practice. But after probably, I don't know, 2 or 3 years there, where I suddenly realised that my partner didn't want to move back to London because he was having an interesting career there.
What was he doing?
He's a filmmaker. Okay. It's documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to. He was. I suppose he used the economic mallet in a way. He said, "If we go back to London, you can earn the living and you know, as an artist." I couldn't keep the two of us going. Mm. Anyway, so I started applying to do my master's overseas, and I got into Hunter College at City University in New York. And so, yeah, he and I made a deal that we'd go and try and see if it worked for both of us. And it was, you know, it was incredible. It was, you know, Robert Morris was my theory lecturer. I had incredible lecturers, and I worked for Solowit for a while. And, you know, the intensity of the program was... I probably did more kind of thinking and kind of intellectual research in that first 6 months than I did in my entire undergraduate degree. And maybe that was just the stage that I was at with my practice, that I had been, you know, so entrenched in kind of thought and my own research that I had a lot that I wanted to work with and through. But
well, that's the late 1990s. So you've
that was
been 97. Out of art school
for three or four years.
Yeah, for a while. Yeah.
Anyway, basically, we ran out of money, so after 6 months, we had to.
Oh, so was that 6 months?
Yeah. So I cross-credited and went to Auckland University.
Oh, okay. So you did your master's.
So I finished my master's there at Elam School of Fine Arts. Mm. And you know, that was
a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was fine. It wasn't. Mm. And again, it was interesting. It was interesting to come back to. Well, look, I mean, it was disappointing leaving New York, but it had its moments. It was still a good program.
When you worked with Solowit in New York, had you done any wall drawings before then, or is that when you
got
interested?
No, that actually the thing I found most exciting about that was I was always very respectful of the canon, the art world canon. Mm. And I'd always seen Solowit as this huge kind of art historical figure, really rigorous conceptual artist. You know, he had all his kind of methodologies and his sentences on conceptual art. When I started working for him, there was a fantastic kind of casualness to his approach. He'd just email, or actually fax at that stage, he'd fax through an A4 drawing, this kind of really kind of quite wiggly drawing, and say, you know, please scale up onto the gallery wall to 25 by 7 metres. And, you know, we'd be doing it by eye. So we'd just hold up this drawing and, you know, do an eye drawing of what he'd sent through. Mm. And we'd do the whole thing. And he'd come in, you know, every 4 or 5 days and say, yeah, that's looking great. You know, just keep going. And it was such a... And I said to him, wow, you know, I've done a series of your drawings. I'd love to, you know, what do you reckon? I could do one at home. I made a bit of a joke. He said, yeah, of course you can. He said, the only thing that gives it any value is the authenticity certificate.
Oh, okay.
But which was really liberating as well. Mm. So, yeah, it had a big influence on me. And I actually started trying to work with assistants after that. But I realised that I'm very hands-on, that I did a lot of work using vinyl and Signwriter's vinyl, very industrial material. And I tried computer cutting it, but it was very deadline, and I tried getting other people to cut it for me. But I just realised that act of doing it is an important part of my process, and that whole sort of tenuousness of the drawn line. I see them as big drawings, really. It was very much just part of my practice. So,
is that, were you working in that medium when you did your master's? What did you do?
Yeah, I actually did quite a lot of work in fiberglass, and I think I already was. Yes, I started using those wall, the vinyl. During my master's.
Time.
Yeah, and I can't even. I was always interested in kind of industrial materials, so like materials from our urban everyday. Mm. But then somehow hand processing those.
Yes.
So I think that's how I got to the Signwriter's vinyl. It's just these fantastic kind of coloured sheets of...
Flexible
materials. Yeah, flexible materials. Mm. Yeah.
And when did you start exhibiting there? Or did you exhibit in New York, or did you exhibit in... when did you start?
Well, I had my first pop-up show in London after art school. I didn't exhibit... Well, I suppose I exhibited in New York in the you know, student. Within the art school, mm-hmm. master's show. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, first semester master's show. But then I was exhibiting in New Zealand from the year after I arrived, this amazing gallery called Gregory Flint Gallery. And I remember when I first arrived in New Zealand, I was, there's an amazing art scene there. Mm. The, you know, within a week of arriving, I went to the Elam de Grees show, and it was really impressive. And then the first gallery I went into had a show of Bill Hammond, this incredible painter. Mm. And I just thought, God, this is really humming. This is really interesting place. So I signed up with that gallery. I've been very fortunate with my relationships with galleries, and so I had an exhibition with him. I suppose a year after arriving. Mm. Yeah.
So you finished your masters, and then what prompted you to move to Sydney? Was that long after? Or?
Yeah, I suppose it was. We moved to Sydney in 2004. Mm. I mean, for both. Well, it's a fairly small country, New Zealand, and I'd been kind of itching to do. I'd been showing a bit in London. Mm. Like I had a show in. I had a quite big show. Actually, that was after I moved here. Anyway, I'd done a few things in London, and it just made sense for both my partner and I to move on. We'd sort of done as much as we could do. Mm. They are sort of shown in quite a few of the public galleries, and he was keen to move. So then Sydney just seemed right, and we had kids by then, and again he was keen not to move back to London, and I'm really happy here. Mm. It's been a really good move.
Mm. So do you live near the studio?
I live in Darlinghurst.
In Darlinghurst,
yeah,
close enough.
Yeah, yeah.
What about this studio? Have you been here for long?
Since 2009, I think. And I had a residency at ArtSpace in 2008. And then I found a studio in Sydney really hard to get. It's unbelievably expensive, and there's not much of it. Mm. And I just sent a mass email out saying, you know, has anyone got any space that they want to share? And Janet Lawrence got back and said, well, you know, I've got this storage area, let's just see how it goes. And it's been the best studio space I've ever had.
Yeah.
So she's fantastic, and it's a really great community. There's Jenny Turpin and Michaela Crawford and Janet Lawrence and a few others about to move in, actually. And it's just fantastic, really great group of people.
Mm. Good group and a good area, and well, it's close to Central
Park,
where you've been doing some work too. So,
yeah.
What did you do when you first came in 2004? Did you know people in the art scene, or did you get a gallery, or what did
you
do?
I was so lucky. I don't know if you know Peter Fay. He's a very unusual person. He's I think an English teacher, an artist, a curator, he's just a fantastically smart, generous, poetic, rigorous human being. He's a really interesting person. And a friend of Darcy's said to Peter, oh, you know, there's this new artist in town. Would you mind having a look at her work and just seeing what you think? And Peter always tells this story. He's like, oh, God, here we go, you know. But he was good friends with Judy, a friend of ours, and he said, I'll do it. And he was just so generous. He looked at the work. He said, "Right, I'm going to call three galleries for you," and he called and he did. And the first one I had a meeting with was Grant Peary, and we just really hit it off. Mm. And they were a really big part of my relationship with Sydney. They really their community of artists.
Yeah, and they've been good at promoting you.
They've been fantastic.
Yeah.
And it was more than a gallery, really. It was like it was a community. It was a really extraordinary community, and that's really made my time in Sydney kind of just a special one, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how about making a living? You've been able to do that?
I have, yeah. I decided... I'd always taught to, you know, so I used to teach at the University of Auckland. I used to teach at Elam right up until I left.
Teaching sculpture?
Yeah, teaching in the sculpture department. And And I had a lectureship, you know, I'd just been given a lectureship, and I was thinking, what I realised was that my own practice couldn't keep up in a way.
Mm.
So I decided, I mean, it was exciting and it was great and I'm glad I did it, but I decided when I got to Sydney that I was going to give myself 2 years to see if I could make a go of it without having to teach. And I can't remember, I can't remember what little jobs I was doing here and there. But, yeah, I basically decided to hold off teaching. I got a residency, that's right, I got free studio space for a while. I was the artist in residence at Bondi Public School.
Oh, yes.
So I did a bit of interaction with the kids there and had this amazing studio and a bit of a grant. I've been making a living.
It's very unusual, actually.
I mean, I can't say it's been a wildly good living, but it's been, a working-class living.
Mm.
But
you have managed to sort of exhibit everywhere. I mean, you've got a huge CV and exhibited all over the world pretty well. Well, rather than discuss all of that, I might just talk about the works in Sydney
the
moment.
Yeah, sure, sure.
And you've continued to exhibit at Grant Perry, have you? Is that...
No, they shut down in 2011. I think I was the second to last show.
Damn.
yeah, that was a shame.
So do you have a gallery now?
I show with Tolano in Melbourne, who are, you know, fantastic. I will get a Sydney gallery at some stage because it's where, I suppose, it's where my community are.
Yes.
And I like having that relationship with a gallery. Mm. It's just Sydney's in a strange place at the moment. There's a lot of galleries that have shut down. Mm. So I'm just seeing what happens.
Yes, fair enough. So, but you've done most of your commissioned work here by looking at your CV. So did that start with the drawings in the... Is it drawings, wall drawings in Deutsche Bank? And
yeah, I think so. I think I did a big piece in Auckland before I left for the City of Sydney there, a big steel piece. But then, yeah, there was... And I found in New Zealand the public galleries were interested in the wall drawings, but just as temporary projects.
Mm.
Whereas in here, people were happier to take a risk and have a wall drawing... you know, because they're quite difficult pieces to, you know, once it's on the wall, you can't take it anywhere.
No.
So I've been, I've had a few commissions. I think Ferrier Hodgson, the Mandelove commissioned, was probably my first one. I did wall drawings and a kind of mobile sculpture piece.
Mm.
And then, yeah, Deutsche Bank. So they've started off, I suppose, as more hands-on, you know, me working in the space for 2 or 3 weeks to get it complete.
What materials do you use for your drawings?
Those are the Signwriters vinyl again. This sort of sticky, you know, sticky plastic.
Oh, it sticks onto the walls?
Yeah.
So do you cut them here or cut them on site?
I cut it on site, actually. Yeah. I just take my rolls of vinyl with me and do it on site.
Mm.
People looking at me, you know, as if I'm completely insane, but sort of coming along for the ride.
We get up to 2012 when you participated in Art and About in Sydney with the installation of two bronze sculptures called Youngsters. Can you describe them for me?
Yeah, they're I'm really interested in the materials of sculpture. So whatever a form is made of, I'm interested in kind of, I suppose, the history of that. Mm. So with bronze, it's such a loaded material. You know, it's the monument. And I'd started to work a little bit with bronze in my previous projects where I have this strange process where I sew a fabric mould and then pour either metal, if they're smaller, or a kind of plaster.
Into a fabric mould?
Into a fabric mould.
So that you, so it would be a rough surface in that case?
Well, it's a really kind of voluminous... Mm. It creates, a sculpture that looks like it's not a solid sculpture. It looks like an inflatable, basically. So it's this solid sculpture that is a bit soft and volume. It will look soft and defies its materiality, I suppose. Mm. So I'd been doing a lot of work and I'd cast a couple of those pieces into bronze and it really played with the materiality of the monument and the anti-monument. And then I was trying to think, you know, what is the 21st century monument? And I was looking at, you know, we're used to seeing monuments as figures of authority, and it's usually, you know, a bloke on a horse or a civic gentleman or something on the whole, unless it's Queen Victoria. And I just thought, well, what is the currency of now? And I'd always been interested in kind of drapery. I did a whole series of fiberglass pieces a number of years ago, just looking at kind of, you know, just a fabric on the floor, and I did a whole series of drapery pieces, and I just started thinking about a diminutive monument to do something again that engages with the kind of urban vernacular, and I, you know, my kid's school uniform is a little hoodie, and so I just decided to make a little girl wearing this hoodie. It's basically the kid's school uniform, just, you know, street shoes, and just have this. So play with this idea of this monument, play with the idea of a kid in a hoodie that, you know, has the hoodie has been seen, I suppose, as a, what's the word, as a subversive, a subversive uniform. And I wanted to undermine that. And so the little girl, she's got plaits. You know, you have to look into the hood. She's got plaits at the back. But I've also played with the ideas of, I suppose, our economy, our mineral economy. So the interior of the hood is encrusted with casts of amethyst, Tasmanian amethyst and coal. And so all through the hood and all through the pockets and all through the, you know, anywhere there's basically would be space. It's encrusted with that. So they're quite surreal pieces. And I've also, I cast a, you know, I'm really interested in, I suppose, colliding, you know, seeing us, humanity, as actually part of the greater natural environment. And talking, I suppose, historically about the consequences of whatever we do has a ripple effect for the environment. So I decided to, so the crystals and the coal are part of that. In a playful way, you know, you could look at the coal as actually being a, you know, there's an easy resonance around coal and the economy, but then the crystals are sort of play with ideas of the spiritual and, you know, the spiritual economy as well. So, but I cast a stingray, and I don't know if you have looked at a stingray closely, but they have very human eyes and mouth. So I've actually, the face of these little people have stingray eyes and mouth.
I was wondering where that came from.
And I just, you know, it's actually just placing us as part of the greater natural world. It's just putting us as an equivalent. So they're quite playful pieces, and also there's a lot of stories in there that I know that maybe other people never will. Like I encrusted into the shoes are, you know, bits of weed seeds and, you know, bits of Roman pottery that my dad have collected, and so there's sort of there's little bits of ballast sort of stuck between the sort of mud and the shoes.
Did you do that in the casting project?
Yeah. So I made an original. I made my original. In the studio,
In clay or
no? It's actually I used a mannequin. I used clothes. I used wax. It was a very odd looking form. And then I worked with a foundry. Worked with the foundry, Crawford's Casting. They made a silicone rubber mold. Then we
would have been tricky with all those protrusions.
Yeah. It was potentially difficult.
And were they made especially for Barrack Street?
The first one, the little...
So there's a standing one and
there's a handstand one.
Handstand one, yeah.
The first one was already shown a year before, and the curators, Vi Gagas and Adam Porter, who approached me to be part
for
of...
Art and About.
Approached me. They curated me into their project. They'd already seen that piece. And thought it would be really interesting in the city.
In the city, yeah.
And then I, you know, we decided that actually a second one would be a really interesting relationship And to have it handstanding, and again the kind of plaits spill out of the hood.
Yeah,
it gives them, they could become like a little team. You know, there's sort of that idea of, oh, well, where's the next one?
Mm.
And I suppose it, yeah,
could have kept going all down the street.
Exactly.
What about how did the public react when they in during the out and about?
Oh, do you know, it's it's actually, I wasn't sure how people would react, but that people have, I've never had such an amazing response to the work, actually. People have really loved it, and they've really embraced it as, I think the scale is because there's nothing intimidating about the scale. They kind of feel like these little moments of silence because, you know, they're so human, but they're so still, and they're so small that they feel quite vulnerable, and... They're on George Street. They're just on the corner of George and Barrack Street. And there's a fruit seller who's right next to one of them. And he gets there really early in the morning. And he was telling me a story. It was a guy in his truck who'd just done some piping work in the street. And he was having his breakfast about 5 a.m. And he said he saw him stop kind of mid-bite. And he was just staring at this little person. And then he just put his sandwich down, got out of the truck and ran to this sculpture. Because he thought it was this little lost person just standing in the street. And it's just, there's been a really positive reaction to it. It's been, yeah.
What about children? I bet children love the scale. You know?
Yeah, there's been quite a few, people have posted quite a few photographs on, well, sent them to me and I think put them on
with
Facebook.
The children.
Of the kids kind of, you know, giving them a cuddle. So it's had a really amazing response. Yeah.
And what's happened to them now?
Well, they're staying. Yeah, what had started as a temporary project, the city decided to keep them permanent. And
they bought them for the public domain?
Yeah, they bought them for their collection. So that's really exciting for me. And I think the city's strategy is really smart of asking professional curators to put projects forward and then showing these projects that would probably never be commissioned. If you were just writing it on paper, you would probably never commission a project like that. Or they'd never, the bureaucratic machine would probably never say yes to a project like that. But then to actually have them in sight, to sort of test them out, I think it's a really interesting way of getting good art into the city. I think the same with those fabulous birdcage pieces.
Yes.
You know, they started as a temporary project, didn't they, and then stayed. So I think it's interesting.
Because it's like testing them before they...
The artist, it works, because the city, you know, they're basically supporting practice. They're supporting you making new work. But if they don't stay, you still have...
You've still got the work.
I think it's... And it allows curators to have an interesting engagement with urban space, because it's a very different thing working out in public space to in galleries. And I really enjoy it. It's one more layer of complexity to work through with the work, is how it engages with a site, or you know, with the public, or with the history.
Well, that was the same. Is it the same year that you did the other work, the other public work? So that was that commissioned?
The Watling's Tree. Watling's Tree, I think, was the year before. And it, you know, the commissioned public works always take a lot longer. I think I got that work 2 or 3 years before it actually finished.
Oh, okay.
Because it had to wait for the upgrade of the laneway. Watling's Tree is in Albion Place, just off George Street. It connects Kent Street and George Street, next to the George Street cinemas, and it's quite a difficult site because there's a pub at one end, and it's a really kind of dark laneway that's used as a urinal for the pub.
Right.
So there's these six alcoves, I think, six alcoves, recessed. They're all basically the emergency exit doors for the cinema.
Okay.
And they were getting more and more feral, basically, tagged and pissed on. And so they've upgraded the whole laneway. And so I came up with an idea that was... Thomas Watling was, I suppose, the first convict artist into Australia, and he was sent here for forgery, and he did these beautiful drawings all around the area. And I found this one drawing that he made of that area, well, what people assume is that area. And it's, you know, he was a great artist, but he wasn't a trained artist. So he's, a lot of his drawings, for me, they speak about psychology, human psychology, I suppose, as much as trying to capture sort of a specimen. So all his trees, they're always a bit wrong. They always look like the sort of European trees cross gum trees. And I'm really interested in that because I think that's the Europeans not getting the landscape has, you know, it still has this effect on the place now. You know, it's still rippling. It's still that misunderstanding is still part of, I suppose, part of the currency of the place. So I basically borrowed his tree and digitized, you know, basically, I suppose, made it my own through drawing and Photoshop and digitized it, and also rotated it so it's upright at one end of the lane, and then it kind of shifts, I think, by 30 degrees each time till it's upside down at the other end of the lane. So it's like this big, it's like it's been windblown. And then that's mirror, it's etched onto a mirror stainless steel. And then it's chromed, which means that people can piss on it and it's not going to deteriorate.
So there's no actual glass over the front
No glass. It's a mirror. Yeah. It's a mirror finish. But but the chroming means that it's it doesn't scratch. So, I mean, it was an interesting project. It was an
different sort of interaction.
Yeah, yeah.
But so that was actually, but it was commissioned by the City of Sydney. Yeah, so you were asked to do that.
It was competition. Okay. And I got it.
So you submitted that actual proposal?
Yeah.
Okay. What about the longevity of those sort of works? Do you think about them sort of staying there? Is there any time limit or what do you think?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, with that. Do you mean in terms of how appropriate or
how long would they stay in that site? Yeah. And the same with the figures, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it'd be really interesting to see. It's always, I suppose I don't really think about what it'd be like. But it'd be really interesting to see what they, especially those little hoodie pieces, you know, what resonance they have in 50 years' time.
Exactly, yeah. I think McCady upstairs was telling me that some of their works have been, there's a 25-year limit or something. They're expected to last for 25 years or something like that when they're commissioned. So I was just wondering if you'd heard of any of that.
No, that's absolutely right. And that's one of the nightmares of public art, is that you're really limited with materials. That's why, you know, with that Albion Place piece, it had to be so tough.
Yes.
I mean, I ended up having to go to, oil refinery technology to have it plated because there wasn't, because of the scale and because of, I mean, most materials that you show in gallery would literally be destroyed within an hour being out on a Saturday night in Sydney. And it's the same with the little youngsters. They're bronze, so they're tough, but they've seen a huge amount of interaction, 10 beers on a Saturday night and people, having
pouring things on them.
Well, more that they get a lot of love. And actually, I love what one of the things I like about bronze is that, you know, these pieces are black, and their patina is just a jet black, which is intentional, but I'm quite enjoying the fact that they get polished. You know, people touch the heads the whole time, so the head is getting really polished, and it has that, you know, it suddenly has this sort of art historical reference to those, those beautiful Italian pieces that, you know, the boar and the Pietà and things that get
their and you can see snouts the shiny polished,
and, and I actually really like that sense of change. But it is something that is such a big part of the nightmare of making public art.
Yeah, yeah. And what about the city's proposal to ban cars in the part of the
George
city?
Street.
Do you think
fantastic.
That's a good idea? Yes.
Great. I mean,
then you could have more sculptures, obviously, in that area if it was...
But know. I actually think just thinks less even about art and more about, you know, public use of space. I mean, cities are for humans. I actually think the more that we engage with public transport, the more we kind of... You know, what use is the car, really? I mean, it's clogging up the networks in time. It's clogging up the environment in fumes. Mm. And also, if you free up space, I mean, people come back into the city.
That's true.
I mean, I've noticed living in Darlinghurst, you know, I lived there maybe 9 years or so. You know, people are coming back into the city. The little school that my kids go to, it was almost at the stage of being on the shutdown list. Mm. You know, it got down to 90 kids.
What school is it?
Darlinghurst.
Oh, yes.
School. Mm. And now there's 250 kids in a waiting list. You know, I think people are really, they're wanting to be back in the city and they're wanting to walk.
Mm.
You know, like loads of people around us have sold their cars. They're using those go-get.
Mm.
You know, it just makes sense to pedestrianise.
Yes.
It makes everything
absolutely
more livable and just really work on that public transport.
Mm.
Yeah, so I'm all for it.
All for it, yeah. Well, I mean, they're building that big, you know, a lot of buildings for residents in the city now, like Central Park, for instance.
Yeah, that's right.
So were you artists in residence at Central Park?
That's what it was called.
Mm.
It was an interesting naming. I think basically, you know, the brewery is a derelict site.
Mm.
So I think... three of us were called artists in residence. There was Brooke Andrew, Michaela Dwyer, and then I was the last project. And it was basically, you know, artist in actually probably artwork in residence is probably the what it was actually. Because it would have been an amazing place to be a resident. So we all basically made works that engaged with, I suppose, the history and future of the site.
What did you do?
I developed a 12-metre inflatable of a tree-like form that I kind of developed one half of a tree and I mirrored it on itself like a Rorschach ink blot.
Mm.
So it's quite abstract.
Mm.
And then, so it's this big kind of red bloom, I suppose, on top of the building. But it's fed by a series of PVC pipes because the building was an old brewery, it was an old water production site, and now it's a trigeneration plant under the site. So pipes have always been a really huge part of the history of the site, so I decided to make the pipes be almost like the circulatory system to feed the inflatable.
Mm.
So they pump air up into the inflatable.
Mm.
So that's, it's been up
12 metres.
12 metres, it's huge, and it... You know, the sense of scale when things are in public space, it just...
Yeah, it'd take up your whole studio.
Well, it doesn't look tall, you know, when it's on top of a four-storey building,
yes,
it suddenly...
looks small. Mm. So, and still up there.
It's still up there. I mean, because the site's being used, you know, and it's been incredibly high winds and, you know, 45-degree days in January, so it's suffered a bit, but yeah, it's still there, still looking all right.
And the pump's still working, everything's
well,
working.
That's the thing, is they keep turning off the power during the building process. So, but you know, even that's quite interesting.
It goes up and down.
It becomes this sort of flaccid looking thing, and then suddenly it kind of booms into...
So was that curated?
The curators invited, I think, 10 artists to pitch ideas, and I was lucky enough to get one. I mean, that's the other thing is with public art, you know, you get a certain number and you don't get it. You know, there's a lot of work.
A lot
in pitching.
Just putting the proposal.
Yeah,
in. Yeah. Absolutely.
So there's a lot that I've been very fortunate in the last few years, but there's been a lot that I haven't got to.
Yes, of course. So have you worked with Jenny and Michaela upstairs at all?
Well, they were part of the curating team for the Central Park one. And that has been really great process to actually work with artists who have worked in public space. And Anne Loxley was the other, there were three curators.
Yeah.
So it was Michaela, Jenny and Anne Loxley, who's at the MCA at the moment. So they're really, really smart. They had this great idea for the artists to work with an engineer straight up. Mm. So they gave you, once you got the project, you actually worked with these engineers to develop it. And you could be as hands-on or as hands-off as you liked. Mm. And they're all really unusual projects, difficult. Mm. And the engineers, Jeremy Sparks, I think he's probably had a huge effect on the art world, because most sculptors I know who worked out in public space work with Jeremy.
Do they?
And he's an engineer who says, oh no, can't do that. Sorry, he doesn't say that. He says the opposite. He says, just give me your wildest idea and I'll do it.
Yes.
We'll sort it out.
Yes.
We'll go backwards from there.
Great.
And he's really, really, that's very unusual.
Yeah,
very,
it is.
And also most sculptors, you know, have enough of a, I suppose, almost a natural engineering head to get a sense of what is feasible and what's not feasible.
Yeah. So something like that one, would you do a scale model? And
yeah.
Then, yeah. And then he would work out the engineering side of it?
The big thing for that piece was the wind loadings, because it's about a metre off the building, which doesn't sound very much, but that's quite a big leverage.
Yes. And it's so high.
Yeah, and it's high. So that was... That was the big part of it. The inflatable itself, and I've worked with the inflatable fabricators a lot, so we already had a working relationship. But yeah, the wind loadings, and there's a steel, you know, there had to be a steel structure inside of the object.
Yeah.
So he, you know, he did the drawings of that and managed the project.
Mm.
So it was great.
And how do you like that collaboration process?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. With the right team, it's just fantastic.
Yeah.
And again, you know, working...
Even though you're hands-on, you sort of...
Yeah.
You can still be controlling, but, you know...
Yeah, I mean, that's right. All the changes that were developed. I mean, with the pipes were really exciting, because basically we hired a crane, we got a plumber, and it was like building a drawing on site. We just did it on the day.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, our left there, down there, you know, another one there. We had a certain number of metres that we could do, and it was very buzzy, yeah.
Mm.
No, I enjoy that collaboration.
Mm. Have you done any more wall drawings at all
No,
in Sydney,
not for a while. I actually have started. What I realised with the wall drawings, with the Signwriters vinyl, that it was only an on-site practice. There was no studio practice.
Yeah.
So I actually started working with PVC, so that I could actually create works that I could develop in the studio as well.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been using, are these flexible PVCs and developing them in the studio. So I cut them all.
Mm.
So I'm still interested in the wall drawing idea, but it tends to be more of a commission.
Do you do any like gallery size works? Do you do drawings, you know, that you would hang in a gallery or scale?
Yeah. I've got another very kooky process that I've developed probably a couple of years ago. Was I started collecting carbon, the exhaust, car exhaust, out of people's cars.
Yeah. How do you collect that?
Well, make sure the engine's turned off, but just the back of the exhaust pipe, you know, it's full of that black gunk.
Yeah, yeah. And that's carbon, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's carbon mixed with sort of a noxious fumes.
Yeah.
I actually want to get it analysed to see exactly what's in it. But I collect it just with a paintbrush and, you know, scrape it out on a knife.
Mm.
And then I mix that with a acrylic binder medium to make a paint.
Mm.
And I've been doing a whole series of drawings using that medium.
Mm.
And I did a piece for Shepperton Art Museum last year where they'd seen this process and they really liked it. And they said, oh, can you come up with an idea for us? Because we've got this 12-metre wall. We'd like you to do something on it. So... it was a really great project. I said, well, could you please ask your community, Shepperton, to collect, you know, their car exhausts?
Yeah.
So they did, you know, and I've got these amazing pigments from, a 1960s tractor, Daimler, you know, Holden, Naro, you know, just these. And then I basically painted endangered species from the Murray-Darling area with the exhaust emission.
Mm.
And then scanned those and photoshopped it up into this sort of massive 5-metre digital drawing that they showed on their large wall.
Mm. Do the carbon have different colours?
It does.
Yeah.
With the older cars, I mean, it's suddenly mixed in with a rust.
Yes.
And some of them are very dense black.
Mm.
Others are, you know, lighter because they've got less emission. Mm. So yeah, there's slightly different colours.
And so the binder medium densities. Will hold it onto the surface.
Yeah, the binder basically surface. Just yeah. turns it into a paint. Mm. It's exactly what the Victorians used to do. I don't know if you've heard the term of lamp black. Mm. So they used to collect the black from inside of those, you know, those lamps.
Yeah, the lamps.
And then mix that with a binder medium okay. to create their yeah. own paint.
I didn't know where that came from.
Yeah, yeah. So this is exactly the same. Mm. I was speaking to Parkers about it. And you know, I say, well, how can I stabilise it so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't rub off? And they're like, oh, that's really easy. It's just what these guys used to do, you know, 150
just
years
put a
ago.
Binder with them.
Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
So, so that's I do a lot of drawing.
Yeah.
But those are the only ones I've started to show.
Mm.
And I got a show in Singapore at the moment with a series of those drawings that I've actually also used gold leaf. Alongside it, you know, just playing with ideas of value.
Against the black carbon. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. And what about exhibiting overseas? Are you still doing that now that you're in Sydney? Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, it's not that easy.
No.
Doing
it's a long
it. Way. And, you know, what I've found is that people, galleries, they want to have a, you know, if somebody comes into the gallery and wants to engage with the work, they often want to come to the studio and, you know, talk to the artist. So, that's a bit of a struggle, but I've got the show on in Singapore. It's a really fabulous show curated by Nina Mile, who's now Sydney-based but was in London for years, with Chiara Shiota, who's a Japanese artist living in Berlin. So that's a really great two-person show. And, you know, I have the odd thing in London still.
Mm.
And, you know, I've been really fortunate with my galleries taking me to international art fairs.
Fairs,
you know.
Yeah.
Grant Perry took me to New Delhi and Hong Kong, and that's been exciting.
Mm. Do you go to those when they're on?
Well, what I've decided is I didn't go to New Delhi. And what I realised is if you don't turn up, there's a different level of engagement with the work, and I've decided to try and go when they're on.
Yeah.
Because... particularly the New Delhi one, I think there are lots of architects particularly that are interested in the work that
yeah.
Was really hard when you're not a face.
Mm,
mm. It's hard to follow up on in a way.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you could get, you know, get commissions or whatever
yeah.
from there.
Yeah.
So when somebody asks you what sort of work do you do?
Yeah, that's a really...
How do you describe it?
That's such a... I hate that question. I usually get my iPhone out and just say, have a flick through. Because...
So that's you need to visualise it, really, to
yeah, it's
explain
a really,
it? Yeah.
Because I suppose my practice is just... I mean, it's just completely across media.
Mm.
It's three-dimensional, it's two-dimensional, it's... I mean, I'm even trying to look at getting a video piece made now.
Mm.
So it's just, you know, I'm not really interested in trying to shut my practice down into a media.
Mm.
I do find, though, that I have these media that I'm now committed to, which seems to be, you know, PVC, kind of bronze, this casting process.
Because you're known for it, yes. Perhaps.
Well, it's just I've sort of, mind you, I do embroideries and, these drawings. I think there's a... I think, you know, I'll use a media that works for the practice.
Mm. Do you ever paint?
Well,
it's
I see that. I see that. I mean, I do use a paintbrush when I'm using those exhausts.
Yes.
So that's a painting
yes,
for me.
Yes, it is. Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
So you don't think of yourself as a sculptor? You wouldn't say you're a sculptor?
Well, I'd probably say I'm more likely to say I'm a sculptor than a painter.
Mm. Sure.
So I do, actually, because I find that even when I'm... Even when I'm, say, painting those carbon drawings,
mm.
the engagement to get to that point has always been sort of... I think sculptors generally engage with material.
Mm.
So it's been a real material
yes.
process to
yeah.
get there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I mean, I'm more likely to call myself an artist necessarily
yes.
than say I'm a sculptor.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And what about any projects in the city coming up? Have you got anything planned?
There is one... one project that I apparently have that's taking a very long time to come through, but there's a building being built in Ultimo, and they want to, it's not an easy project actually. People want a lot but they want their kind of iconic clad artwork onto their panels.
Mm.
And the idea I came up with to digital print onto the panels looks like it had to go to Germany and come back, and you know, it's just a bit complex. Yeah. But that's hopefully going to happen next year. Mm. Key Street in Altamont.
Yes. So a lot of your time is spent actually sort of applying things and doing that, as well as the, you know, sketches and the
early. I mean, I've actually become a little bit. I used to say yes to everything that I was asked to apply for. Mm. I've become a little bit more selective now because I spent a lot of time applying for things that, you know, there's so much work in putting an idea together. Sure. So I'm a bit more selective now that where I think that I actually might have a look in. Mm. You know, if it's a call for proposals and there's 50 artists applying, then I probably won't do it. But I will if I'm invited to, you know, if I'm one of five or even one of ten.
Sure.
Then I'll. Mm. And it's an interesting site. And my mortgage needs it. Then I'll apply for it.
Do you work with assistants? You mentioned that when you did with the solar wit. Do you?
I don't. You know, I don't work with assistants in the studio. Mm. I probably have to bite the bullet a little bit at some stage and do that. I still, unfortunately, even though I'm earning a living, I'm only just earning a living, and I'm not earning a living actually well enough to be able to
afford an assistant. Yes, of course.
Afford an assistant, unfortunately, and I don't. I probably should. I don't like not paying people. You know, I know there is the system where you can actually get an intern, but it just doesn't feel right for me. And maybe I should, because I know probably as a young artist I would have actually happily gone and worked with an artist for a few weeks.
Yeah.
But having said that, I mean, I suppose effectively the foundry, you know, that's
you're
working.
You're collaborating with people, yeah.
Yeah, I'm working with people a lot on the bigger projects. Mm.
How do you organise your day if you've got children?
Yeah, my kids are luckily heading towards 10 and 13, so they're at that age where they're much more independent. I'm very lucky, you know, my partner is completely hands-on. Mm. I'm also just really, I'm just a bit obsessive, so I just drop the kids to school, I'm straight to the studio. Mm. You know, they do a bit of after-school care, I work at night, I just, it depends on my projects, but I'm really... You know, I have two things in my life, and that's the studio and that's the family. And, you know, when I'm not with one, I'm at the other.
Yeah.
And, you know, like school holidays about to start, they'll just come in here. And
oh, will they? They'll come in here?
Do a few things.
Yeah.
They quite like it for a few hours.
And your husband's still working in documentary filmmaking here?
Yeah, he's...
So it's sort of flexible in that, you know, you can share the
sort kids. Of. that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's good. Well, that's probably about all I need to ask at the moment. So thank you very much. That's great. So,
did I draw a breath? How long is that?